Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. As the diverse populations of the world move increasingly toward a global civilization, elements in every society resist and clamor violently for separation and for racial and cultural purification. In country after country, obstinate, bigoted or fanatical fringe groups and individuals resist with the power that brutality and terrorism bestow. In the United States, the ancient and atrocious issue of white supremacy and dominance, the persecution of other races and of religions not puritanically Christian, is once more a major theme in American politics. It is the far right that now talks of revolution, that sets up paramilitary training camps, patterning its concepts and plans for a white revolt on a fictional account of an Aryan revolution that was written by a disaffected University of Oregon physics teacher nearly half a century ago. And with a surprising suddenness with the rise of Trump, it seems as if the complex fabric of democracy, tolerance, and human rights in the United States is threatened with collapse, resulting from unchecked corruption, deceit, and malice. The so-called alt-right holds rallies in several American cities for the single purpose of spreading fear and hatred and to create havoc and violence, such as one planned for Portland this Sunday, in which a prominent Republican politician claims the necessity of allowing right-wing militia to act as security forces to combat violent responses the rallies foment, subverting local law and order. These rallies are nearly identical blueprints of early Nazi tactics that undermined the post-World War I Weimar Republic in Germany. White supremacists, racists, shield their hate speech with the First Amendment, which would be among the first freedoms squelched if they get their way. Today's program is a response to the murders of two Portland men last Friday who attempted to protect two Muslim women from racist attack on a commuter train. And it is also, as the final segment, an anti-war pacifist response to a grotesque memory of Israel's six-day war of June 1967, now at its 50th anniversary. I begin with, simply being sorry is not enough. Attacks like Portland's will keep happening unless we all fight white supremacy. By Arjun Singh Sethi. When Ricky Best and Taliesin Namkhai Mechi boarded a light rail train in Portland, Oregon, Friday night, May 26th, they never could have imagined they would not make it home. The two men were stabbed to death after confronting a man for yelling slurs at two Muslim women. A third intervener, Micah David Cole, is being treated for serious non-life-threatening injuries. The suspect, a white supremacist known to police, openly performed Nazi salutes and shouted racial slurs at a rally last month in Portland. White supremacist, Islamophobic, and anti-Semitic posts were a fixture on his Facebook page. Communities of color experience hate in every aspect of our lives. It braids through our daily experience, just like friendship, work, and family. We encounter it in schools, workplaces, and public life. And what we fear most is hate violence, the kind that was on full display in Portland this past weekend. Muslims, Arabs, Sikhs, and South Asians are acutely vulnerable to hate. Since the 2016 presidential election, the Southern Poverty Law Center has tracked more than 1,000 bias-related incidents, many against Muslims. It also has reported that the number of anti-Muslim organizations in the United States grew from 32 in 2015 to 101 in 2016. Muslim women often bear the brunt of this mistreatment, especially if they wear the hijab. The slurs uttered at the two Muslim women on the train in Portland occur regularly nationwide. In the aftermath of a tragedy like this one, there is usually an outpouring of emotion and an important set of rapid responses. We decry the violence, raise money for the victims' families, and push local prosecutors to file hate crime charges. Community groups also encourage the reporting and tracking of hate crimes, as reporting remains voluntary, not mandatory. In addition, we ask affected communities to be vigilant and watchful. The threat of copycat attacks is real and can be deadly. Some of these efforts are underway in Portland. These are important and time-tested interventions, but they are not enough. Hate violence will continue to be a scourge in the United States if we don't root out the bigotry and animus that cultivate it. We must acknowledge, condemn, and combat white supremacy. The belief that white people are superior to other races is responsible for some of the greatest tragedies in modern history. Manifest Destiny, the genocide of Native Americans, slavery, Jim Crow, and even mass incarceration are inextricably rooted in white supremacy. This belief system proliferates in the United States, including in places such as Portland, where local community organizations such as the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon and Unite Oregon have fought tirelessly to combat it. Hundreds of hate groups now champion white supremacy and draw inspiration from President Trump, whose rhetoric and policies have emboldened their nativism and prejudice. The number of hate groups in the nation increased in 2016 for the second consecutive year. Some of these groups skulked in the shadows before Trump. Now they bask in the limelight. Threats, assault, vandalism, nooses, and murder make the headline almost every day. Some of what these hate groups say and do is protected by the First Amendment, but there are still plenty of ways to combat their ideology. In the wake of Trump's travel ban, people rallied in the streets and airports to condemn what they believed to be prejudice and discrimination against Muslims. The groundswell of support made a difference in the litigation and in the hearts and minds of Muslims and others worldwide. Why can't the public show the same energy and resolve when white supremacy and hate violence strike our communities? Many of you will have the opportunity to raise your voice soon. Act for America, the largest anti-Muslim grassroots organization in the country, recently announced a series of anti-Muslim protests in 23 cities, including Portland. Counter-rallies and other forms of resistance are planned and will be announced. Local and national organizations nationwide have been fighting white supremacy for decades. Connect with them, support them, and raise your voice. We cannot and must not shoulder this burden alone. In addition to condemnation and protest, hold teach-ins on white supremacy at your houses of worship and community centers. Invite and center communities affected by hate, violence. Listen to their stories and be guided by their needs and leadership. As a Sikh American and a member of a community acutely impacted by hate, I can tell you every intervention matters. Hate thrives in company. It dies in solitude. Nor should you wait for white supremacists to strike first. Coalitions of diverse professionals, including teachers, coaches, counselors, public health professionals, and community leaders, should develop programming and interventions to track, treat, and curb hate locally. Networks like this also allow us to more effectively respond to hate violence whenever it appears. This programming should also include upstander training. We must honor the memories of those who were killed in Portland by standing for the same principles they did: courage, sacrifice, and justice, not shying away from them. We must likewise reject government policies that treat communities as inherently suspect. Such policies foster misunderstanding, fear, and bigotry. Muslims, Arabs, and South Asians live under a specter of securitization and surveillance. Counterterrorism programs such as watch lists and federal profiling guidelines look upon our communities as guilty and dangerous. Other communities are disproportionately affected by police violence, mass incarceration, and deportation. Those with multiple identities, such as black Muslims or LGBTQ immigrants, experience a devastating compounding of these policies. Trump has intensified this second-class citizenship through immigration raids and the specter of bans and walls. He continues to view Muslims as valuable only insofar as they fight and condemn terrorism. His recent statements commemorating Ramadan focused mainly on violence and terrorism, and only of the sort ostensibly committed in the name of Islam. an array of elected officials and civic leaders will condemn the Portland tragedy in the coming days. But will they condemn the criminalization and national security policies that cultivate hate and bigotry? Will they help illuminate and dismantle these policies, which inevitably reinforce notions of white privilege and prejudice? If the government sees our communities as inherently suspect and unworthy of dignity and respect, so will everyday Americans. Finally, the media and public must be held accountable for double standards that mischaracterize violence and terrorism. White suspects who perpetrate mass atrocities are often humanized and described as shooters and mentally ill lone wolves. They are seen as holding personal grievances and capable of rehabilitation. But when the suspect is Muslim, brown, or black, or a combination thereof, they are often described as terrorists who are deliberately evil, inspired by collective grievances, incapable of intervention. This familiar accounting happened last weekend when the spokesperson for the Portland police wondered whether the suspect had mental health issues. The result is that we obscure how white supremacy informs hate violence in the United States and lose an opportunity to combat it, just as we would other hateful ideologies. The racist narrative also diminishes the pain and suffering our communities endure. It means the tragedies inflicted on us sometimes don't even make front page news. We fear the Islamic State as much as white supremacy, and so should you. The greatest threat facing our country comes from homegrown white supremacists, not Muslims or refugees. Yet we don't treat it with the requisite level of urgency because we dismiss these acts of violence as isolated incidents rather than manifestations of a deeper ideology rooted in hate. Today, I remember Ricky Best and Taliesin Namakai Machi, the heroes of Portland. Their selfless sacrifice will live forever. And that was Simply Being Sorry Is Not Enough by Arjun Singh Sethi, who is a civil rights lawyer, writer, teacher, and consultant who lives in Washington, D.C. He is an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center and Vanderbilt University Law School, where he teaches courses on policing, surveillance, and counterterrorism. And now, something I wrote, Where the Nuts Roll. Oregonians surely remember the right-wing white supremacist militia occupation of Malheur at the beginning of last year that was a precursor to the Trump era's current firestorm of malignant racism and civil intolerance raging through the nation. The Pacific Northwest is an attractive area for a whites-only civilization for a number of reasons, among them its underdevelopment and relatively sparse and scattered population, which is overwhelmingly white and, with notable exceptions, generally conservative. It might not be altogether surprising that white supremacist groups would prefer the Northwest as a starting point for seizing the country, despite a popular vision of the region as an ecotopia of political, multicultural, and environmental harmony. The plan to make the Northwest an Aryan homeland would roughly encompass an area stretching from the Tehachapi Mountains of Central California north to Homer, Alaska, although Canada might be allowed to keep British Columbia, and from the Pacific Ocean to the Rocky Mountains. Eastern Washington and northern Idaho, in particular, are, as one writer said, where the nuts roll. The idea of an Aryan homeland has fostered a migration to the Pacific Northwest, which accounts for much of militia groupings. Although the white supremacy migration has met with considerable local resistance, the Northwest is a fertile nursery for grim visions and savage philosophies. Economic upheaval makes rural Oregon a primary recruiting ground for militias and other hate groups. Militia organizers have claimed a few hundred members in Marion, Polk, and Lane counties, and also groups in the central and southern parts of the state. Militia members are active in Portland, along with other white supremacist hate groups. The Posse Comitatus started in Portland. The Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party have long had strong influence in the region. The KKK was founded after the Civil War to rob and murder blacks and prevent them from benefiting from their release from slavery. It has had periods of major influence, most notably in the 1920s, when it was nationally powerful, particularly in the South and Northwest. The KKK was especially popular in Oregon during the 1920s. It helped elect a governor in 1922, Walter Pierce, and influenced both houses of the state legislature. Most of the Oregon KKK's wrath was focused on Jews, Catholics, and aliens, primarily Chinese and Japanese immigrants. Homosexuals were deep in the closet and escaped the KKK's attention. There was little activity against blacks because they were fewer in Oregon than furtive and fugitive gays, although their population greatly increased during World War II to work in the shipyards and other war industries. Oregon is the only state whose constitution banned blacks. The American Nazi Party, which has had vigorous renaissance since Trump's election, is a nativist offshoot of the original National Socialist Party that was started in Germany in 1919. It is perhaps the most virulent of the white supremacist groups and openly preaches a domestic sequel to the Holocaust of World War II that eliminated millions of Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, mentally and physically handicapped, and political deviants. American Nazis have committed many acts of violence, including murder, which includes the two Portland men last weekend. There are also smaller ad hoc groups, locally grown and primarily of youthful nihilistic rebellion that openly approve of fascist ideology. A Portland example, the New Order Legion was organized several years ago as the moderate voice of fascism, that's a quote, described as authoritarian rather than totalitarian, opposed to violence and terrorism except in, quote, specific instances, yet dedicated to the eradication of non-whites, feminism, abortion, homosexuality, sounds almost Republican, and also of Khazars, a Turkish tribe that allegedly infiltrated European Judaism several centuries ago, and whose members, Aryan anti-Semitists say, claim to be Jews. The so-called Khazar theory is formed of the basic scripture of the white supremacy movement, Anglo-Israelism, which is known also as Christian identity and kingdom identity. Anglo-Israelism is the fantastical claim that God promised Israel would change its name and go west to occupy new islands and new nations. Only the Western Europeans, especially the British and Americans, met the explicit criteria of being the chosen people. Christian identity seems to be based on an obscure 19th century doctrine called British Israelism, which holds that Anglo-Saxons are the true Jews of the Bible, and the modern Jews are Satanists. Underneath the surface of this zany concept is the chilling suggestion that the Nazis were the children of Israel, and the 6 million Jews they exterminated were imposters. The CSA Journal, weekly organ of a very far-right group, shrieked quite luridly in one edition, "There will be economic collapse, riots in the cities, famine, and war. It will be so bad that parents will eat their children. Communists will kill white Christians and mutilate them. Witches and satanic Jews will offer people up as sacrifices to their gods, openly and proudly. Blacks will rape and kill white women. Homosexuals sodomize whoever they can. All but the elect will have the mark of the beast." Such are the dreams and worldview of white supremacists. They worship the rituals of violence and form a primarily male brotherhood of ecclesiastical vengeance. They speak of other races as if they were separate species and have no sympathy with the interconnectedness of races, cultures, and knowledge. Life to them is a perpetual race war they must win. Although many upper-level public officials, notably the new president, openly and often vigorously sympathize with the white supremacists, the radical right would have serious problems mounting an internal coup d'etat or despotically subverting the persistently edgy citizenry, despite claims of extremists. Purging all the people on the far right's menu of removal, blacks and Jews, not to mention Hispanics, Asians, women, liberals, homosexuals, left-handers, and assorted other undesirables, would entail the largest domestic bloodbath since the Civil War and would rival Stalin's massive pogroms of the 1930s and late 1940s. The fanatical fringe has no patience with such subtleties. Its purpose is to cleanse American society in the same manner the Nazis sought to achieve in Germany and much of Europe. Who would be removed next? Perhaps persons of intellect and education, as happened in Cambodia, and people who disagree that the United States is a white Christian nation, or criticize the rabid racism and anti-Semitism that is a cornerstone of that faith, they would most likely also be removed. Not long ago in Germany, a neo-Nazi leader said that he and his followers loved Adolf Hitler as devoutly as Christians love Jesus Christ. In the United States, the KKK, the American Nazi Party, the Aryan Nations, various militias, and the rest of the Christian Kingdom Identity Movement have merged Hitler and Christ into the same deity. The fringe is starting to become the normal. This is where the nuts roll. And that was something I wrote, where the nuts roll. And now something else I wrote, actually today, in 1969, June 1st. I call it the Highest Patriotic Act, and I wrote it for the newspaper I was working for, the North Long Beach Herald-American in Long Beach, California. It is very hot and lonely in the world's deserts, the burnt, scarred wastes ruled by sand, which moves slowly over the millennia, to cover all living things except for a straggly few, covering even the bodies. How many were there? Hundreds, thousands, in that desolate pass, left to the carrion after the jets fell upon them with tons and tons of napalm. The cremated bodies looked like barbecued wood when Barry Spatz stumbled upon them in June 1967, 2 weeks after the Six-Day War fought and won by Israel. Most of the Egyptian army had been found and trapped in the 3-mile Mitla Pass in the Sinai Desert, and the Israelis filled it with napalm until the ground was black and smoking, and tanks melted and fused, and nothing was left alive. Spatz saw the broken pyres of mangled, incinerated bodies and smelled their rot in that giant charred oven, something even the pilots who killed them could not do. You see, I saw exactly and forever what war was, and thank God I saw it without being involved, trapped into it as one of the murderers, he tried to explain, his voice quiet and devoid of irony. The irony lies in his situation. A 23-year-old college graduate with a bachelor's degree in political science returned to this country apprehensive of the military draft. The same day he registered as a conscientious objector, he voluntarily applied for the 2-year civilian service program, which is an alternative to military service. I knew I was obligated. I wasn't trying to duck it, Spatz said, but I thought of doing some work of humane service, possibly as a teacher in the ghettos. It was not to be. The draft board gave him 30 days to come up with work, or they would do it for him. At first, he thought his position with the Long Beach, California Harbor Department might qualify. He was an engineering aide doing survey and mapping work and preparing color displays for the Harbor Commission. The draft board, local board 123, said no. They told me that my service had to be a definite disruption of my normal life, and they have taken pains to accomplish that object. Resigned to his obligation and its restrictions, Spatz informed the Harbor Department and applied for a leave of absence, such as would be granted any other person serving under the Selective Service. The director of the port denied my request, and that same day he called the city attorney's office to get a legal ruling because he knew he had stuck his neck out, Spatz said, acknowledging that he had differences with his employers, but not because of his work, which he said had been openly considered outstanding. He believed the difficulties arose through his disdain to truss himself up in a tie, and he wore his hair a little long. Within 2 days, the city attorney came back with a ruling saying that civilian service was not defined as armed forces in the Universal Military Training and Service Act, Spatz said. What could I do? I had to leave for 2 years, so I submitted a letter to the port director saying that with or without a leave of absence, I was leaving that Friday. The Harbor Commission was told that Spatz had been absent without authorization and subsequently notified he was fired. The board upheld the action. They knew I was going. That letter expressed it explicitly, Spatz said. It's still 2 years, whether Army or civilian work, and I believe I am entitled to get the job back. I think they are basically nitpicking. He did not know what sort of job he would be given. According to him, the board picks the area. The man picks the job. It could be as a hospital orderly in Cleveland, for all I know. They suggest that I drive a Goodwill truck, Spatz said. That's all well and good, but I've got a degree and I'm reasonably intelligent, and I think the government should use that to good purpose. I want to do something to stop this madness of murder and slaughter. I guess you could say something I, as a person, could do and feel and know what is being done to help another person and more. Why did he choose the hard road of conscientious objection? That ghostly corpse-strewn pass in the Sinai Desert was not just the shocking realization of what he calls insanity. It was the reality and culmination of what he had been working up to for a long time. I was confronted with what I thought I am, Spatz said. I am by nature nonviolent. I cannot accept violence. It is to me insane. The whole idea of organized warfare is mass insanity, organized murder. I had been all for Israel. I have to admit that, but I can never justify or rationalize what had been done to those men, those hundreds, thousands, I don't know how many. I felt like I was every one of them, and I felt like I was the killers, too, and I can't find the words. I felt sick, sick in my heart, my stomach, my head. He was afraid after that to return to the States. But the draft was, he said, an obligation he thought he had to face. I am entirely against the Vietnam War for so many reasons, and I imagine some would call me a communist, Spatz said. I don't think people in this country can understand. Even the soldiers are forced to conform and keep quiet about the slaughter and horror. We haven't had a war destroying our homes and our lives, and those who are killed die in some far-off place, and their families don't even see them until the mortician has painted them up and made them to look nice. If they are too mangled, the families are advised to keep the coffin closed, and most probably never see the dead if they are that bad. Television isn't the same as the gut-level experience, and it's just too late once you're in it, Spatz said. What can you do? I was lucky to have the insanity and butchery right before my eyes without having been corrupted by it. I would rather live for my country, Barry Spatz concluded. That's the highest patriotic act. Dying is so useless and self-defeating, and really, so easy to do. It takes more guts to live for what you believe, to work every day through whatever hardship to help people understand and cherish brotherhood. And that was the Highest Patriotic Act, which I wrote today, June 1st, 1969, for the North Long Beach Herald American. The Six-Day War was fought June 5th to 10th, 1967. The 75th anniversary of the Battle of Midway is also this next week, June 3rd to 6th, 1942. June 6th is D-Day, 1944. Epic spillings of blood, human blood, that changed the course of World War II. Some of you might be old enough to remember. And I'd like to close the program with something by Karl Kraus from The Last Days of Mankind, which he wrote in 1926. Optimist, but all wars have ended with peace. Fault finder, not this one. This one has not taken place on the surface of life. No, it has raged inside life itself. The front has been extended to the whole country, and there it will stay. And this changed life, if there still is life, will be accomplished by the old spiritual condition. The world is perishing and won't know it. Everything was yesterday and will be forgotten. No one will see today or be afraid of tomorrow. They will forget that the war was lost, forget they began it, forget they fought it. That is why the war won't end. And this has been